Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wallop with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I won't say boys and girls because we probably scared off all of the younger people because we're about to talk about economics. Oh, the dreary science, the dismal science. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and I'm Jake McClure. Jeff is still out. My dad, old Baldy, the man with the white beard, he's still out taking fantastic and glorious pictures of the nighttime sky. He will be back next week. So I am going to venture onto the air alone. Every week that we do that, it's a little bit of a challenge. So if you could join in the conversation, I would appreciate it. The phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. And please keep the subject at least loosely based on economics. Otherwise, the depth of my ignorance will be plumbed and you will know it is vast. All right, so what's happened this week? The S&P 500 was up for the week, being the one of the largest jumps up in a week for several years. It was up 2.41%, ending at a kind of cool random number that doesn't look so random of 2727.72, 2727.72. What does that even mean? We'll talk about that a little bit. The U.S. Treasury note, which is, we've talked about this in the last several weeks, the 3% scare and all of that, it rose above 3% again this week, closed out at 2.969. When you use three decimal points in a percentage, which is already supposed to have two decimal points in it, it's like five decimal points. I would normally round that up to a 3. If you've got a 2.969, that would generally, in my opinion, be a 3%, but it's not quite the round number. Gold this week was ended up at 1,319.5 or $1,319.50 an ounce. That's up 0.27%. Oil. Specifically, West Texas Intermediate, that's American oil. It's funny how Texas is American oil. It rose about 1.12% for the week, and that's up about 18% for this year, and almost 43% up for the 12-month period. It closed out the week at $70.57. The dollar was just about the same as it was to other currencies at the beginning and end of the week. That's down about 4.37% from a year ago. Okay, so what does all that stuff mean? First off, the S&P 500 being up, only up as much as it was this week, is interesting because the first quarter earnings have now been reported for 444 of the S&P 500 companies. That for those of you who aren't aware, S&P 500, the 500 generally means the number of companies in that index. Though sometimes it's more than 500 and sometimes less. Go figure. I mean, if you've got the name, if in your name is the number of companies, then I'll let you finish that thought. Anyway, 78% of those 444 companies beat estimates for their earnings, and 75% beat revenue estimates. Well, what's the difference between earnings and revenue? Revenue is money coming in. Earnings is what is left over after all the expenses and taxes and so on. So earnings is up 78%. That's, even better than that. Earnings 78% of earnings beat estimates. Earnings are up 24.5% from a year ago for these companies as a whole. S&P 500 earnings up 24.5%. So why did we have only a minor blip upward in the market? I mean, 2.4% is kind of nice, but what happened there? Well, number one, these earnings aren't expected to increase at this rate into the future. This is a direct result of the tax cut. when you calculate revenue and you calculate earnings. Revenue is how much money you brought in, and earnings are what's left over after all expenses. And one of the major areas of expense is taxes. That shouldn't be news to anybody there. When taxes go down for corporations, their earnings go up. So we had this boom in earnings. We've talked about this all year. All year being, we're already into the middle part of May. How did that happen? So all year we've been talking about earnings and how the earnings are way up because of the tax situation. So why is the market relatively flat for the entire year when, you know, we're talking about some pretty fantastic earnings here? I think anybody that's listened to us for very long knows the answer before I get started. There's a lot of uncertainty right now. Tariffs. Not just uncertainty, but certainty of uncertainty. We know that there's going to be more uncertainty into the future. One of the many headlines that I saw this week was that quotas are coming back online. That's something that we saw in the 70s when you've got to each country has a given quota, and any import that we bring from that company, from that country, has to meet the quota. We have a cutoff amount. If they have gone above the quota, we cut them off. Well, why is that a problem? You know, when it sounds kind of good on the front side, in that if they're exporting way too much to us, we should have a quota on them. Say, hey, stop that. Well, number one, free market says if you want to buy something and you're willing to pay for it, why should the government get involved to stop you? I like the buy local campaigns, but if Temple said, if you buy an automobile from Belton, then we're going to charge you money, or you're only allowed to buy Temple residents are only allowed to buy 300 cars from Belton. Well, now Belton has to count the number of cars it sold to Temple residents, which means there's another layer of regulation. There's the Temple regulation, then there's the Belton regulation. That makes trade flow very slowly. It puts a lot of regulation and restriction on an area that wasn't there before. When we're talking about tariffs and quotas today, particularly from an administration who has complained about overregulation, rightly so, we've had way too much regulation, and has been extremely proud of their efforts to decrease regulation and to lower taxes, to then immediately go turn around and raise taxes, which is what a tariff is, and raise regulations in an area that we haven't been overly regulated in. It seems a little hypocritical. So there, that is what the market's looking at. The market looks around and says, you know, this last portion of the bull market that we've seen has been driven upward by earnings. But we just had this big boost in earnings, and the market hasn't. In fact, the market had a correction, which we're just about recovered from. What do we do there? We've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, enjoy the show. Last week or so, there's been a lot of videos about the robot dog and from Boston Dynamics,
right.
And I think they had a robot mule a couple of years ago.
Still have it, yeah.
And then the backflipping
the robot humanoid, guy. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know robots have been around since the 70s for, you know, painting and welding, but these are kind of new. I can see applications for, like, in the military for resupply and mm-hmm. maybe bomb disposal and stuff, but I know you're kind of a futurist research guy. What, other than the military, what do you see for these kinds of robot technologies? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. I really appreciate that call. That is right up my alley. Thank you very much. All right. What do I see? Well, let's, you know, the dog robot, the Boston Dynamics. Let's talk about the difference between the industrial robots coming from the 1970s on and the robots that we're seeing coming out today. because this is going to give us the foundation on what can be done beyond this. Boston Dynamics' first sets of contracts and research money did come from the military. DARPA was a big investor in Boston Dynamics. So the older robots weren't really robots. I mean, they were roboticized. They performed a function, but they performed a function very similar to any kind of cylinder-driven engine. They made identical movements every time. So if it was putting a bolt on a car, that car had to be stopped precisely in the right spot for that bolt to go in the right spot from the machine. And that's been one of the limiting aspects of robots till now. The robotics today are able to some effect intellectually, intelligently determine where the bolt needs to go. It doesn't have to be exactly precisely placed every time. It has a program and it has the ability to look at its environment and adjust to the environment instead of having the environment adjust to it. So right now, bomb disposal is a pretty effective use of robots, whether that's remote control or autonomous, but we'll cover the remote control. Next we had human controlled. So we went from the program is it moves exactly the same way every time. And if anything messes that up, you got to stop the whole industrial line. To, all right, now we can remotely control these things. And we saw a lot of that coming in, you know, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, little robots, even in the in earthquake relief, that sort of thing, sending robots in with a remote control to places where humans can't go. And that's typically, it's radio-controlled, which has some limitations. The first drones were pretty much the same thing. So one example of that would be a cruise missile. The first cruise missiles were a huge leap forward in technology, but they were essentially a 1970s industrial robot. They knew the location they needed to fly to before they left, before they were shot up through a tube or whatever. So they went exactly to that location. If the target moved, it couldn't alter the target. It couldn't change where it was being shot. Same's true on a aircraft. When you have autopilot turned on, it's a very, very simple program that says at specific preset coordinates, change your heading by this many degrees. It's a very preset, totally human input. No decision on the part of the airplane. The airplane doesn't say, I decide to move here, unless it's broken. The newer machines are now able to do something that we considered nigh impossible not that long ago, which is, you know, the humanoid thing, to be able to traverse a hill, not a specially designed hill that has a specific grade and gradients and bumps are all known and so on. No, this is a robot that can climb up a hill without knowing the hill in advance. There's an autonomous nature to that. Autonomy is the first step. Once a problem has been thoroughly researched by a computer that's good at machine learning, once that problem's been really thoroughly researched, then anything to do with that problem, the machine can start to make decisions on that in many cases are better decisions than a human's. If you can think back to Deep Blue, IBM's big machine that beat Kasparov at chess. And more recently, Google's machine that beat at Go. Go is the most complicated game on the planet, and the computer learned enough about it to quickly beat the world champion human and has since had another layer of intelligence added to another machine who turned around and beat the machine that beat the champion very quickly. Once we understand a problem really thoroughly, and what's more, the computer understands a problem really thoroughly, anything to do with that problem, it can make good decisions about. So when we're talking about an industrial line, that's great. When you're talking about a robot that can wander around, open doors, go and fetch a drink for you out of the refrigerator, you're starting to get into something that's a lot more Jetsons-esque. It won't be that long. Well, we've already got the technology. It's too expensive. But it won't be that long before this expense comes down for a robot that can rinse and load the dishes into the dishwasher. I've got a Roomba in my house. It goes around and vacuums up. Now, there are other competing brands to that, but that's an iRobot brand. Boston, for some reason, has the corner on the robotics market in the United States. A huge number of really advanced robotics companies in Boston. What's the next step? Well, the next step is if a computer's driving your car, you know, it's not a robot, except that the car becomes the robot now. It's not a self-driving car. That's a robot. If it's making the decisions on changing lanes and where to park and how fast to drive, that's a robot. If we've got combines that are going out and harvesting corn, right now we've got in mass production, a lot of farms are using the GPS coordinate where the farmer sits in the combine for a few minutes and inputs the coordinates, or now they just do it on their computer and send it wirelessly. And then those combines go out and drive their preset coordinates. Well, this is very much like autopilot on the aircraft in the 1970s industrial machines, where they did exactly what they were told and nothing else. What's coming is, how do you pick tomatoes? Because tomatoes are a little bit more fragile than corn. You can't just toss them around, or nobody wants to buy them. So a tomato picker has to be gentle as it picks the tomatoes. It has to know which tomatoes to pick. Don't pick the green ones, only the red ones, unless somebody wants fried green tomatoes. And then they can be told, hey, I need a certain percentage of green tomatoes out of this field. The farmer doesn't have to say, only pick this tomato right here. He can give looser controls to the robot, who then goes out and does exactly that. And eventually, the farmer's not involved anymore. The robot understands what to do, and we're starting to see this in urban farms, where they have some difficulty getting the fresh produce into the inner city in time for it to still be fresh due to traffic and shipping and costs of energy and all that. So they have kind of high-rise looking farms inside cities where you've got multiple layers of plants and vegetables growing, and machines that are going and specifically watering, checking the soil content for acids and different amounts of fertilizer. The pH level is the acid area, the humidity of the air, what the air content is, how much CO2, how much oxygen, checking specifically how much nitrogen and so on is in the soil. Now, this isn't Boston Dynamics. This is general kind of, anybody can do this with an Arduino. Arduino being a really cheap, easy to buy, easy to program processor and interface, and it's got a lot of other cool add-ons that go to it. Or Raspberry Pi. Raspberry Pi, I wish it was something that was edible, but it is as fun as the edible thing. It's a similar kind of concept as the Arduino. There are some differences. The idea here is that the more convenient we can make life, the better. This is something that's been going on for a very long time. This is why we're not still riding horses. We're driving cars. Eventually, the cars will drive themselves. Therefore, they become the robot. The Boston Dynamics side of things, imagine a humanoid robot working on a road, turning a sign saying stop or slow when you're stopped for traffic because there is another robot backhoe that is digging up the road ahead of you. And eventually it won't have a sign that says stop or slow when all the cars are driving themselves. It will just have some signal that says stop here and go there. That's that's what we're going to be seeing. And at some point, those humanoid robots can get to places that tracked and wheeled robots can't. So at this point, I wouldn't buy a Boston Dynamics robot, except for the gimmick of it. It's not going to make my life better. For the cost of the robot, it may go and get something from the refrigerator for me, but it's not quite to the level where it knows what exactly it needs to get, unless I put my groceries in exactly the same way every time, or at least pretty close to the same way. So where we are in robotics is leaps and bounds ahead of where we were, but there's still more to come. The idea that a robot can look at a log and do a backflip over it when it hasn't had that log's location or the fact that there is a log there preset into its mind. Mind being a pretty loose statement here.
3 minute stations.
The idea here is that eventually the convenience is going to be enough that if you want, hey, take the trash out to the street, and your robot will do it for you. The robots of today are loud, clunky, a little bit annoying, not very smart. They're a lot smarter than they used to be, but telling it to take the trash out is probably not worth the many thousands of dollars it would cost to get the robot, unless you just like to impress all your neighbors with a robot taking your trash out. I mean, some people are up for that. That is the cost of being at the bleeding edge of technology, is that you get a lot of money for a relatively small convenience increase. So where's it going? Well, eventually, we won't take the trash out. What will those robots look like? I don't know. And it may be that trash will be treated something different in our own home. It may be that we will process the trash locally so that we get compost and we get the recycling that we need to do on site. That's not a big stretch. And that's something, you know, people that have listened to me in the past talking about steel technology and how America has fallen behind because we spent so much money early on the steel and how to develop steel. And there's cheaper ways of doing it today. Those cheaper ways are going to continue to get cheaper. And if we're able to recycle the aluminum on site by having a slightly hotter oven, for instance, slightly being, depending on how you look at it, might be greatly hotter, but it only needs to be about 1,200 degrees to recycle aluminum. And then you could print it out yourself. So we're really talking about orders of magnitudes of different lifestyle in the future that we're starting to see the bare smidgens of. And if you recall back to the early statements from companies that we shake our heads about, nobody will ever need a personal computer from Xerox. The executives there saying, who would ever want to have their own computer? That's, you know, the computer at the time, nobody really needed to have that. It would make pretty pictures that weren't very pretty. They were black and green, and you could tell that they were made of letters. That's why would anybody want to have that? Well, that's what we see when we're looking at the robots of today. And the scope and speed of the change is going to be much higher. I have another subject I'm going to be changing to now. And that is because the president, President Trump, gave a speech yesterday on drug prices and so on. And I get a lot of questions. This is like the hot question now that people aren't asking me about Bitcoin anymore. They're scared of Bitcoin. And now they're talking about, well, they never stopped talking about it, but it's in here. Marijuana. Should I buy marijuana stocks? What is it? What do we even call it? Is it cannabis? Is it pot? Is it weed? Yeah, it's all those things. First off, do I advise people to buy cannabis or marijuana stocks? No. I don't advise individual stocks, period, because there's a lot of risk there. If someone is pretty capable of taking the risk and knows that buying individual stocks can lead to higher risk, and then they jump in and they say, cannabis! Well, there's a lot more dangers having to do with the cannabis side of things, and this is, you know, state of Texas still sees cannabis as illegal. The federal government still sees cannabis as illegal. that puts some pretty severe restrictions on the profits of a company that's working with cannabis, because the IRS does not allow them to write off any of their expenses. So if you're a small business owner and you buy a piece of equipment and that piece of equipment is for your business and it makes you money, you're allowed to write off the expense of that equipment because you're going to be paying more taxes in the future because you're making more money. It's a pretty reasonable way of doing taxes. If you're growing cannabis and you buy a piece of equipment, whatever that might be, including the robotic type grow facilities, you can't write it off, which means you get a boost to the expense of that of somewhere between 20 and 30%. And that hits the bottom line. That's important. Another thing is that if the banks know what you're doing with the money, they're not going to let you use their facilities. So you can't use a credit card machine unless you've lied to the bank somehow. So, or you're using kind of a sketchy, higher expense credit card company. So keep those things in mind. It means that there's an uphill battle. But those aren't really the big reasons. The fact that everybody asks, should I get involved in cannabis stocks, says something about the demand. It's very much like what I heard in the late 90s, early 2000 era about dot-coms. Just because they have dot-com doesn't make them profitable. Oregon is an example of something that's going on right now, but it's happened in every single state that has done recreational marijuana. There is an overabundance of marijuana in Oregon. They overdid it because everybody threw money into it and everybody saw this as an opportunity to make a huge amount of money. And in the process, they took the price and cut it by more than half because there's too much supply. So the concept of, hey, this is a place that you can make a lot of profit, it's true about this area as well as every other area, that at the beginning, at the young stages of a technology or a crop, and we'll call it a technology here, you have a lot of business startups. At the beginning of the automobile industry, there were hundreds of major, what would were considered major at the time, automobile manufacturers. Well, which one of those made it? Well, we were down to the big three, and only two of them are still American. Tesla's out there now, so now we got four. But if you think about that for a minute, you can see some of the risk involved. When there's a new area that everybody can look at and say, hey, if this is legal, it's legitimate, people are going to want to use this, there's a demand for it, there's nobody supplying it now. If everybody jumps in and doesn't coordinate with each other, what you have is a way oversupply at the end of the first growing season. That's what's going on in Oregon, but it's happened in every state that's gone recreational. The first year, they have this massive inflow of money from everybody that's asking me if they if they should do cannabis stocks, and everybody else that's thinking cannabis stocks, they throw their money in there. Right now is not the time to do it unless you're able to do some really good research. It's just like any other industry, except that it's got some much more expensive components to it. Now, is it possible to make a great deal of money in cannabis stocks? Yes, it is. But it's dangerous. Not only dangerous from a legal context, but dangerous from the risk context, in that you have to wind up with the one that makes it instead of the 10 that don't. That's true with any small business investment, and that's what we're talking about with cannabis now. Now, if a major industry, a major pharmaceutical company or a beer and wine company got involved and they hired good people and they didn't start with a massive bureaucracy and it became legal, then we're talking about the same kind of research that you need to do for any company that you buy. Just because it's new and flashy doesn't mean you should just jump in. It means that research is still something that you absolutely should do before taking the next step. And I've got to play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side. I've got some more to talk about on this subject and on the subject of the prices of pharmaceutical products at the pharmacy. Well, you know, we've had a lot of complaints about that. The president had a lot of statements about it in the campaign and the speech that he gave yesterday. And I'll go into that in some more detail, because it is a major portion of our economy, and the stock market has a lot to do with this. So I am going to play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side. If you would like to join me, I'm Jake McClure. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. The phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. And I'll be back on the other side. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and if you would like to join the conversation, anything to do with economics or the next step in the future, how it will affect the economy, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. I said I was going to talk about the president's speech about pharmaceutical prices and how he wants to lower them. I was kind of disappointed in the speech. I don't want to be overly disappointed, because this is kind of the norm for politics. And I'll kind of give some background to that so that it doesn't sound like I'm being too rough on any particular person. When Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were debating in his first election, when they're debating on the health care bill that became the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, really didn't have a lot of Obama's stamp on it. It had Nancy Pelosi's stamp on it, but Obama signed it, and it was his impetus that brought it to the vote. The debate lined out two very different plans for changing the insurance world. And the bill that wound up being passed and signed by President Obama looked a lot more like the plan that Hillary Clinton was advocating for rather than the one that he was advocating for. One thing that he said in his debates was that a mandatory tax on not having insurance was unconstitutional. Well, then that was part of his plan when Nancy Pelosi did it. Coming forward, we have the current administration, Donald Trump, who said some very reasonable things about prescription drug costs and how to bring them down during the campaign that were clearly missing from his speech yesterday. And I've got a caller on 773-1400, so I'm going to jump to that before I get too deep into this. Caller, you're on the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. My question is this. When Obama had all that money sent to Iran on pallets, where did all this money come from? And if we're in such debt, you know, the government itself, I'm just curious to find out what all this money went to, and how did they get all this money to send that way? Thank you.
All right. Well, that's getting into the money going out is much more a political argument, because you got to look at, if you deposit a dollar in your bank account, and you worked at two different jobs during that time period, and say you deposit $10 from each job, now you've got $20 in the bank, and you pull a dollar out, where did that dollar come from? Well, it's all been mixed together at this point. It's really hard to say which job did that dollar come from, and it doesn't really make any sense anymore. It really didn't come from any of those, because the dollar that you put, the $10 from each place that you put in the bank, is not the same $10 that they would give you from the bank. They gave that to somebody else. So where tracking specifically money comes from gets very silly in my mind. If you say half of it came from one job, half from the other, that means half of each dollar that you pull out is there. Okay, so some of the money that was sent to Iran came from debt. Some of it came from taxes. It's really hard to tell where. The act of sending the money to Iran was a payment that was blocked when we first put embargoes and sanctions on Iran. It happened to go on the same day that hostages were released, because in our agreement with Iran, that was the day that payments were to be made to set debts right across the board and to bring hostages home across the board. If you think about it like a company merger, they say you're going to pay these back debts on by this date, and they usually wait till the last date to do it. Well, that's exactly what happened here. It's really easy to look at that money and say this had to be paying for the hostages until you read the agreement, and then you say, no, this was paying for seized money that we took from Iran, from a company that really wasn't part of the problem, except that we said to Iran, all of you is the problem. I'm okay with that. That's a normal process in an agreement. If we look and see what's just happened in North Korea, what you'll find out is that a very similar set of things is going on there. Is it the United States paying ransom for the three people coming back? No. No, it's not. We've seized a lot of assets of North Korea's. We've paid them back for those assets if we're going to be in part of a negotiation for peace. That's just part of diplomacy. If we're talking about Cuba, this is one of the reasons why we're still not on good footing with Cuba. Cuba, the government of Cuba, seized a huge amount of American-owned assets when Castro took over. Massive amounts of money was seized from the United States. If we're talking about Venezuela, when they nationalized several oil companies, they just didn't pay the oil companies. They just took it. It went to the World Court. It went to all these things. But if you're Iran or North Korea or Venezuela or Cuba, you don't care what the World Court says. So you don't pay attention to it. You don't pay any money out. In order for us to open up trade with them, they've got to pay back their debts. They seized assets of ours. We seized assets of theirs. That's part of the agreement. It goes forward like that. In the case of Iran, this is one of the sillinesses of the modern world. It went across as cash, blocks of paper money, because at that point, we still hadn't opened up the bank commerce yet. So if the government pays in cash, it's no more a crime than if a citizen pays in cash. We do need to watch what they pay, and we do need to understand why it is that they paid it. But getting into conspiracy theories about Obama is just as easy to do with Trump. Both presidents are working on negotiating with erstwhile countries that are not big rule followers. They set their own rules. We're not big rule followers either. We set our own rules, but we're powerful enough that people have gone along with them. So just kind of keep that in mind. The deal with Korea, North Korea, may have more to do with the fact that they destroyed their testing facility than any threats or name-calling. I'm happy for it any way we look at it. If we can get them to stop testing the nuclear weapons, then the whole world is a bit safer. But are we paying ransom for the three Americans that just came back? Well, if you look at it and you say we just released a bunch of money to the North Koreans, does it look like ransom? Unless you know all of the other details, it does. So keep that in mind when you're thinking about the Obama release of money to Iran to get, at the same time, hostages out of Iran and then a deal signed. We're about to possibly, hopefully, sign a deal with North Korea. If we sign that deal with North Korea, expect money to flow out of our country into North Korea. That's just how these deals work. Was it ransom? I don't think so. If you're talking about a terrorist taking a hostage, like what happened in the Iranian embassy, if we had paid the terrorist organizations or even Iran directly to release those hostages, that would have been ransom. But when we seize assets that already belonged to Iran, and then in the process of making the deal say, we'll give you those assets back, that's not ransom. That belonged to them to begin with. So keep that in mind. When we're talking about government, this is a kind of a nice little segue back to the original subject. There's a lot of talk about deep state. because the current administration, our president, has been deregulating and has gotten a lot of resistance to deregulation. And there's this thought that it's deep state, or the investigations going on having to do with the president. Deep state is kind of a new word, and it has a lot of these conspiracy theory backgrounds to it. As you know, the deep state is doing these things. Let's kind of address that. I'm going to go back a bit, because if we look at our tax code, even the new one, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's not rational. It was created by committees working with other committees, working with other committees, with way too many sets of input and not balanced input. That's the way most laws get passed. You don't get balanced input. You get, this is what's passing, and if you didn't get your input in or you got voted out, this is what passes. It's not very well pre-planned. But the law has a whole set of requirements that says that, for instance, in a tax law, that the IRS has to make rules and regulations to help enforce that law. What is the definition of the things that were written in the law? Well, the IRS has to come up with that and has to say, this is how we're going to pursue money in these cases, or this is what we call this stuff. That's kind of the definition of the deep state. Congress just delegated power to the executive branch. The executive branch here is the IRS. That falls directly under the Treasury, which falls directly under the President of the United States. Now, Congress gets to give them mandates and says to them, you've got to come up with rules to do this. Another example is, for people that have been listening to this, not a whole lot of people in the world or in the country know a lot about the fiduciary rule, but we've talked about it quite a bit. The fiduciary rule began as a concept in the Pension Protection Act of 2006. And then Dodd-Frank pushed it forward even further and said the Labor Department and the SEC have to come up with some definitions for fiduciary and implement the standard after a lot of testing. So there's a law on the books that says that these organizations in the government have to do something. If a new president comes along and says, don't do that, then there's a quandary. There's a conundrum. Because there is a mandate from two different branches of the government to the same people. How do we move forward? This is the same thing that happens when we have a government shutdown, by the way. We've got to pay the debt of the United States. We don't have to pay the salaries of the people that work for the United States. So the Treasury Department, if Congress doesn't release money, they've got to figure out, okay, well, we just don't pay the salaries because we got to pay the debt. That's constitutional. Is that deep state? Because the government's supposed to be shut down. Where are they getting the money to pay the debt? Well, it's not deep state. It's the delegated authority that the legislative branch has given to the executive branch. In this case, what we're seeing in the current administration is the president, based on promises that he's given, is working really hard to deregulate. He's not going through the established channels to do it. Established channels, what does that mean? Well, that's kind of the deep state. There have been a huge layer of laws that have been built over the years that say, here's how we do things. Here are the regulations to meet this law. Here's the regulations to meet that law. The president can't change those laws. He can tell them rewrite the regulation if he does it in the right ways, because sometimes the laws say you can't rewrite the legislation or you can't rewrite the regulation. So deep state is something that we designed into the system. It's the bureaucracy that Congress didn't want to have in their own area of government. They handed it off to someone else. It's very much like how we do debt. Originally, we did debt where Congress would pass a spending bill, and if that meant we had to borrow money at the same time, usually with the same vote, they would pass a borrowing bill that went with it. Eventually, that got to be too much. They weren't even reading the first bill, much less the second bill. So they wrote a new bill that said to the Treasury Department, you borrow the money, we'll spend it. just come back to us when you reach this particular maximum. We call that the debt ceiling. So Congress told the executive branch, you're allowed to borrow as much as you want to get the spending done that we're doing. That's deep state, if you want to call it deep state. Delegation of authority is what deep state is. If authority has been delegated by law, the only way to undelegate that is by law. You can't just take it back. So if any administration, whether that's Barack Obama talking about the pushback that he was getting on a whole series of the actions that he was doing, or if it's Donald Trump getting pushback on a whole series of the things that he's doing, it's because the president has limited authority. The president cannot change written law. He can, or she can, eventually maybe there's going to be a female at some point in the future. The president is allowed to say, here's within my area of flexibility, here are the changes that I can make going forward. So when we're talking about pharmaceuticals, one of the things that was part of the speeches that were made by the president when he was still on campaign was to get the government to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies when it comes to Medicare and the drug care, Medicare Part D, the prescription drug care benefit that was signed into law by a Republican Congress with a Republican president. Hold that in mind for just a second. I'm not bashing the Republicans here. Anytime you have a single party in Congress and in the White House, the kind of law gets passed that delegates power to the executive branch. And when you have a deadlocked Congress or a Congress that is on the opposite party, the party that passed that law regrets it. Congress was designed, as particularly the House of Representatives, to be relatively short-sighted. The Senate's designed to be the long-sighted ones, the ones that make better decisions. Well, we passed this tax code, which was supposed to be simplified. It wasn't simplified. We passed the drug care, prescription drug care benefit to Medicare with a full Republican Congress, Senate, and House, as well as Republican in the White House. And part of it was that the government couldn't negotiate with the private pharmaceuticals because it would be too big a negotiation. It would be breaking the arms of the pharmaceutical companies unless there was some kind of preset way of negotiating. It's in the law, which means the president can't change it without Congress changing the law. So it'd be great if we could negotiate at the governmental level for the drug prices. In the meantime, the things that the president said to do instead, because he was told his limitations, talking about fining other countries or having other countries negotiate in a different way. He also mentioned importing from other countries drugs that they bought from American pharmaceuticals. There's just some craziness going on there. Well, basically, I've got to come back and say, this is in the lap of Congress. And we got to get some cross-party lines communication going, or we're going to see drug prescription drug plans go up in price forever. And I'm about out of time this hour. I've got more stuff to talk about next hour, lots more. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we do give a fiduciary personalized investment advice to people with high net worths. There's a voicemail waiting during the weekend at 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. You can email me directly at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
KTM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.